I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present, Senator Rauscher, Senator Myers, Senator Dunbar, Senator Klayman. Senator Kawasaki will be on his way shortly. Vice Chair Wilikowski is here, and so am I, Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Kyla for helping us out with the minutes and the audio. We have a super interesting presentation today from the Rail Belt Transmission Update, Alaska Energy Authority, and they've brought show-and-tell piece that everyone can try to lift later. And we're also going to have a presentation from the Port of Anchorage Energy Project from Terry Amundton, Port Director of the Port of Anchorage. So we'll start out with Alaska Energy Authority, and I'll welcome Curtis there to the table. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. All right. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And as we start every presentation, a little about AEA programs and services. Primarily, we'll be focused today on our owned assets, which is the Bradley Lake Hydro Facility, the Alaska Intertie, what we call the Sterling to Quartz Creek Transmission Line, and the Cook Inlet Power Link, which is a sample in front of the chair. We also do the Power Cost Equalization Program, which is a $46 million program that helps rural Alaska, 188 communities in rural Alaska, offset their high cost. And it looks at the cost of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which is roughly 20 cents a kilowatt, and will pay up to 75 cents a kilowatt into rural Alaska to help offset those costs. Also in rural Alaska, we have bulk fuel upgrades, rural power system upgrades we do. We also have a circuit rider program where we have four people that travel in rural Alaska doing training, and also for several communities, they are the 911 call if the lights go out and they have problems. And we also respond, obviously, to electrical emergency assistance. We do a lot with renewable energy, whether that be biomass, electric vehicles. The NEVI, the National Electric Vehicle Program, lives within that program. It's $37 million is one of those programs. We have two other grants, $37 million each, total of $74 for home energy rebates and home efficiencies, which we do partner with Alaska Housing on. They're a better fit in a sense that they have the programs. They did not qualify for the grant. We qualified for it, but we work together on those type of opportunities so we don't create two silos. We have one, and we can get the money to where it needs to go. We also have grants and loans, which we will, if we have time, we can talk about the Renewable Energy Fund, the REF. We also have the Power Project Fund and several federal grants. One of the things I will say with the Power Project Fund is after the typhoon this past fall, several communities, we have lent them bridge money from that fund because they need to do emergency repairs, but their FEMA money wasn't quite there yet, so we provided the bridge funding to help those communities. Energy planning, whether it be the Governor's Task Force, State Energy Security Profile, which is a requirement every year that be updated, we do that. And then we do have an electric library that is forward-facing. We have 12,000 documents on it, so if you want to find things that we've done going back our 50 years, you can type it in and pull anything up. We've scanned everything. And then we have a 401D grid resilience program, which we can talk about a little bit later. We have the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, which is currently in its fourth week of hearings at the RCA. I will leave it at that. Hopefully there's closing arguments this week. The two biggest items on the rail belt for the status update is the Bradley Lake expansion. We've been talking that for a long time. The total cost is about $400 million. Through the legislature and AEA, we have raised $20.7 million for pre-construction cost. And we'll talk about funding in a little bit later. But we're at the point where we did file our initial FERC amendment last month. They look at it roughly with FERC for about four months, and then we file the formal application or amendment. And that normally would take 18 to 2 years, but we've been working with FERC ahead of time, answering a lot of questions, met with all five FERC chair or FERC commissioners. We've had some travel out to Bradley, and they think they can do the review in less than a year. Let's just say, which is huge. It means we could probably be in construction possibly by spring of next year or early summer. The second item, there's more on this later, but the Cook Inlet Power Link, also known as the GRIP application. The cost of that is $413 million. We have $270 million identified. Funds still needed is about $142 million. The Bradley Lake expansion itself.
If you could pause for a moment, Mr. Thayer, Senator Klayman had a question.
Is the display here, does this relate back to the?
That relates back to the GRIP application, the Cook Inlet Power Link.
Follow up. So this would be the cable that gets laid down to transfer the power.
Yes, and to put it a little bit in perspective, it weighs 30 pounds for a foot of it, and we need 80 miles of it. And if you look, there's a lot of copper in there. And then you have the insulator along with stainless steel protector and then the sheath that goes around it.
We could pass it around.
You're more than welcome. It is heavy, and you're more than welcome to pass it around.
I mean, I'm hesitant to reach over to pick it up. One of you stronger people like to pick it up?
It's pass fine. It around.
I don't know what it weighs, but it's heavy. I held it. It's
heavy. 30 pounds.
It's not 30 pounds, but it's heavier than I want to reach forward.
Right there.
It's right here.
There you go. I have a question, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. While we're enjoying this, so we've called it it's a GRIP funding. I think we've called it the HVDC line in the past.
Yes.
So is PowerLink the new nomenclature? Is this the branding we're going with?
We're going with the Cook Inlet PowerLink.
Okay.
Because when we're doing our federal applications on different items, they don't know it as GRIP or HVDC. That was what the project is. We know internally, but we do use Cook Inlet PowerLink.
So, okay. So we will all hopefully start referring to it as the Cook Inlet PowerLink. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with the Bradley expansion, I mentioned that we've already filed the draft amendment. It will increase Bradley by about 50%, which is about 30,000 homes. The target completion for Bradley would be 2031 to have water flowing. That will displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas, which is 7.5% of the unmet need of it. A little bit on the schedule as far as Bradley is concerned, where you see where we are in 2026. The reason that we had a light year last year is getting all the geotechnical work and environmental work done. And then we have working in 27. We are looking at in Washington, D.C. for federal funding. I have a slide on that, and I'll... the Cook Inlet Power Link, which you have, you see it a resemblance. This is a lighter weight of cable, but similar of how it is spooled, and then will be a jet will create a trench that we laid in the trench. There needs to be two of those for redundancy across Cook Inlet, and this will be able to handle up to 200 megawatts bidirectional. So you could have one going one way or another way. Needing. And really, we don't have any redundancy off of Cook Inlet or out of the Kenai Peninsula, and we need to have redundant lines all the way to Fairbanks. And I'm not recommending it, but if we were FERC regulated, there would be a requirement that we have two lines. And we've had some very, very close calls. We had the fire down on Swan Lake Fire about 5 years ago. The Northern Utilities were cut off from power for 5 months, or 4 months, excuse me, but it was in the summertime. But it still cost the ratepayers $12 million more because they didn't have access to the Bradley low-cost power. And for the first time in a long time, we were spilling water over the dam. And then just a couple of years ago, we had a line, we had a boulder, an avalanche and a boulder almost take out a tower, kind of a tower of ours. But if that tower had gone down, if that boulder had taken that tower out, it probably would have pulled two or three more down, and we would have been, Fairbanks would have been cut off from power from South Central for probably several months at least until you could get that, until you get it rebuilt. So there's been several close calls.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair, I was just wondering, if we were to have the money to order this cable, because I don't believe it's on order yet, correct?
That's correct.
If we were to have the money to order this cable, how long does it take for it to actually be delivered to the project?
Through the chair, the lead time is looking at probably about 3 years. The one thing I will mention in it is just saying, as other projects, wind projects on the East Coast have been canceled or delayed, that has actually freed up some of the build slots, but it's still quite a process for what we need. And for what we need, we actually, it's very impressive here when you look at it. Some of the cabling on the East Coast is even larger, and it's too large for us to use. So we can't take advantage of that, you know, but we would have to have that specially built in that for Alaska. And that was the representation of it.
And one quick follow-up.
Yes, follow-up, Rauscher.
Where's the projected place it would come from?
We would look to have it in the United States or with one of our partners, not China. There's only a few places in the world that can build that. And there is, but we are looking for U.S. build of that.
Okay, thank you.
The Cook Inlet Power Link, we do have, like I said, we've identified money that we have. We have, the legislature has given us about $14 million. We had a bond of $50 million that we repurposed for the Cook Inlet Power Link match. And so when you see very little spend in 24 and 25, we had the, I guess the experience of being doged. And so we had to go through a whole process for 3 months looking at our project. And I will say at the end of the project, two-thirds of the GRIP projects were canceled. Only a third moved forward. And we moved forward in that. And they actually said that we had one of the best projects and the most furthest along of any state. And so they actually gave us like a 3 month head start to say, go forth. You're not going to get the formal letter. We've got to cancel others, but go ahead and do. And so what you see here in for 26 and 27, that's when we're doing a lot of the environmental, a lot of the engineering. And that is also the timeline in 27, 28, when we need to order and put down on building the cable. And then you see the construction as the continue. And then the other part is actually laying it, because you have to order a ship to do that. And that takes a year, at least in advance, to have a ship available to lay the cable. And by the grant agreement, by federal law, we have to have this in service by 2032. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've been looking at is the Department of Energy has kind of said, where's your line of sight on your balance of your grip match? And so that's been an ongoing conversation. They're not threatening to take it away. They're just saying, tell us how you're going to get the money. How are we going to complete this project in the next 5 years? Very good questions. With that brings the fact that we've engaged, some partners. Hutton is a law firm in DC. They're helping us with a tax credit, which I'll talk about in a minute. We have ORIC, which is our bond counsel, but obviously financing and energy and infrastructure is key. And then we've also had PFM, which is Public Financing Advisory and Capital Planning. And some information that I don't have that I will share with you when I do have it is they're running modeling like on Bradley as far as the cost per kilowatt depending on tax credits and different variances, so we can see what the cost is actually to the consumer down to the kilowatt. And so we're running all those financial models right now. And so we have good professionals. PFM and ORIC we've worked with for years. Hutton is a new addition, but that was because of the tax credit, and we don't have expertise on the tax credit. But potential financing partners. The first one is the Department of Energy, Energy Dominance Financing. They normally do large-scale projects. They don't normally like to touch anything under $1 billion. But we've approached them, and they are currently reviewing a 1,000-page application we submitted on Bradley Lake and transmission. And they're in that review. There's still additional information we need to get them. But they're looking at how they can possibly finance $400 million, and their rate is a treasury bond. So you're looking at 4.5% money. There's some fee, there's some points, and then they charge 3/8 also for the money. And there's different, with the term sheet, obviously there's different conditions of when you can take the money and advance it and paying it back and everything of that nature. And at the same time, there's the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Utilities Services, RUS, Special Borrowing Program. And we're engaged with them in completing an application to look at, you know, we don't want to put them, we're kind of putting them side by side. The USDA actually has the same treasury bond, but their rate is 1/8, not 3/8. But of course, they have different terms of financing and paying it back. And so we have to weigh all those. And then on top of that, Bradley qualifies for tax exempt bonds. That actually is a provision that Senator Stevens had put in 35 years ago, we discovered. And with that, so there's the advantage of possibly using part of the capital stack in the tax-exempt bonds. We have already gone to the state and secured $342 million, which was available from the state last year for this project. Not saying we're going to use them, but again, it helps add to the stack. It gives us additional options. In addition to that, we have the National Rural Utilities Cooperative. That's how we currently, their market, but they specialize in utility financing. They financed Bradley. They financed our upgrades lately, so we're an active borrower from them. But again, with them, it's at current rates. And then also looking at the taxable bond market, which is something that we have the ability to do, is looking at the bond market and going out into the market itself. So there's going to be a combination of something. And for our internal processes, this is not something that I get to decide. This is something that goes to our board of directors. They will look at it in addition to that and approve it. But in addition to that, the utility boards are going to have to approve the term sheets, because at the end of the day, they were the ones that agreed to be on the hook to pay for this. This project will be owned by AEA, but they're going to be the ultimate users of the power. And we, in our conversations with them, we're going to use the same amount of power that each one receives. For example, Chugach gets 56% of Bradley water, so they will get 56% of the Bradley diversion, and they will pay 56% of the cost associated with it. Golden Valley gets 17%. They will pay 17% of the cost of this. And this has been this is the power sales agreement we've had for 35 years, so it's pretty straightforward. And obviously, we do have interest from other parties wishing to buy power, but obviously our focus is on the utilities and having them have that option first. A little bonus that I like to put in here as far as an investment tax credit, and that is that Bradley could qualify up to $100 million potential tax credit. It's somewhere between 6 to 25% of the total project cost. So it could be 24 million, could be 25, it could be $100 million. This was actually in the Big Beautiful Bill, and you have to increase capacity. And we're not changing the nameplate capacity of the dam, because we're raising the dam 16 feet, and we are doing the directional drill to put more water into it. There will be a little bit of additional head pressure. And so this is where there is a provision that the Secretary of Treasury could look at it and make a determination if this would qualify. So we have met with the Deputy Secretary of Treasury, met with him, met with, I will say, six tax attorneys that never smiled. But when we left the meeting, we got word from Senator Sullivan's office that the Secretary wanted to work with us on this to see if there was a way to make sure that we qualified for a tax credit. We're not asking for anything. We're asking for something special, because the bill's new and nobody's asked for this provision before, this particular qualification. So we're working through it. That's where Hunton comes in. They're helping us with that as far as writing or developing that process of asking. But again, what this would be is if Bradley's $400 million and we get $100 million at completion, then we can apply that $100 million against the project right there. And it's a $300 million project.
Senator Dunbar, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain a little bit more how these tax credits would work? Because you're a tax-exempt organization. So are you selling them or providing them to industry in some way? Or how does it work exactly?
That's the interesting thing, through the chair. That's one of the interesting things with these tax credits, that upon completion, we can sell the tax credits during the process because we'll know if we qualify in advance, or the federal government will write us a check. It was something that has to incentivize and work with infrastructure projects. So normally, yes, if you pay taxes, you would get a tax credit off it. Instead, they'll give us an elective tax credit and write us a check even as a nonprofit.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
One thing with these projects, like the investment tax credits, Cook Inlet Power Link or the GRIP, it does not qualify. So some of these don't qualify. Also, the Department of Energy won't loan on the project, on the cabling project, the GRIP funding, because they already gave us the $206 million, so they don't want to double dip. Mm-hmm. But this is where the Department of Ags come in, and they say that this was kind of an interesting conversation. We met with a gentleman who worked there 35 years, and he said, let me think. I said, you guys had a loan in 1980. Let me look that up. He says, you're considered a good borrower. You automatically qualify. And so that's why we're doing an application with them, who we didn't even know. We paid the loan off 20 years ago. But he remembered that we had one and researched it enough to figure out that we qualify. And so we're going down that path with him. And so those are some of the different funding opportunities that we're looking at. We realize money's tight here in Juneau. If you found somebody tall in a Norwegian sweater that was a leprechaun, then obviously we would like to see it go towards the Cook Inlet Power Link, because that's the one where we have fewer options to finance. Bradley has a lot of interest due to the size and the fact the utilities are backing it.
Gotcha. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. So was there a limit we were qualified for, did he say? How much would we be qualified for? You said we were pre-qualified.
Well, through the chair, that was part of the application process, because sometimes it's 80%, and then they look at match, and then they have to determine what is considered match. And so those are the conversations that we're having, is because stack is a little bit different. There might be where we might need to bond partially, and then we get 80% from USDA. So those are some of the financial modeling that we're trying to run to determine what is going to be the capital stack and the cost to the consumer.
So it's a real
Senator Rauscher.
It's a little more complicated than just flat qualified for X amount of dollars.
Yeah, through the chair, very much so. A perfect example, and I'll use the Department of Energy funding, going back to the Bradley. They don't require you to pay the loan back until after it's in service. Where if you use Department of Agriculture loan, they want to see payback starting within 2 years, whether it's built or not. So one has a 3/8, one has a 1/8, but they have different qualifications in a sense. It's a numbers game to look to see what has the best impact, because obviously you would want to go, when you look at it on the surface, USDA T-bond 1/8 is a great deal. But if Department of Energy is T-bond plus 3/8, but it delays your financing with no penalty until after it's in service, there's a value to that. And so those are the things that we are modeling and trying to figure out what is the best stack. Because our board and obviously the utility boards are going to be asking those same questions.
Appreciate the qualification. Thank you.
I guess that's where I do have a couple more slides just in general on AEA. But I don't want to, if there's any other questions on the SIP link, or sorry, the Cook Inlet Power Link or Bradley.
I don't see any.
All right. Next item is we have the Rail Belt Transmission Organization. I did mention that it is currently in hearing the fourth week. It is with AEA and the utilities, in addition to the Rail Belt Reliability Council, is for the RTO. The RTO did receive its certificate to operate from the RCA in May 6, 2026. And on July 1st, the RTO proposed an open access tariff transmission with the RCA, and that's what they're currently adjudicating. And they're supposed to have an order due by June 4th, 2026, fairly quick. But at the end of the day, that doesn't resolve all the outstanding issues. It creates the AO, it gives us the tariff. Now we've got to study what is the tariff modeling. Once the RCA, how do you lift certain costs? The other thing, and I'll just say this because it's an open docket, and I want to be careful, but there's 15 interveners. So I don't know at the end of the day when the commission comes out with their final ruling if we've made 15 people happy or not. And the next case would be they could adjudicate it in the courts if they did not feel that it was satisfactory. So it's not just AEA and the utilities. We have other friends involved in this. And so we're working through that process. So
good.
One item I just want to bring is Renewable Energy Fund, which is round 18. We did send to the legislature 29 applications totaling $41 million for consideration for the FY27 capital budget. I think I will just leave it there because, again, it's a matter of math and whether there's funding or not. These are all good projects. And in the back of the PowerPoint in the addendum, we list the projects. We've sent the projects with all the background on them. One thing we know is this program has displaced about 13 million gallons a year, about 120 since the beginning of it. And we're able to, a lot of communities are able to get additional funding from private or federal sources to help do some of these projects. Bradley Lake was a REF project. Way back when they used the REF project and the utilities were willing to match the state for $1 million, and that's when we did their first $2 million worth of work and went, you know, this is a viable project. We need to take it to the next step, and now we're with FERC, and it's, you know, like I said, that's probably the closest example for many. Rural energy infrastructure. Again, these are, and I appreciate those that the two of the powerhouses when they are, when we're constructing them in South Central Alaska and the tours. But we have 170 of them in rural communities. We have about $300 million in deferred maintenance. Bulk fuel, we have over 400 facilities and $1 billion. And when I say we, AEA does not own this. We, our statute say we may, but a lot of times I think the state has taken on an AEA, the moral obligation of helping these communities in rural Alaska with their powerhouse and bulk fuel needs. So when I say we will take site control. We will work with the communities, bring in the new powerhouse, do the bulk rail upgrades, and then we give it back to the community. With that though, which actually is new from, I think, last year, we've been working closely with the Denali Commission and partner with Alaska Native Health Consortium, as well as AVAC, the Alaska Village Electric Co-op, and we received $100 million from the EPA for infrastructure upgrades, and that focus was on bulk fuel tanks. And so we've identified, when we've met, we have a list of vulnerable communities, the top 25 that we're required to do, both powerhouse and bulk fuel. And we identified the top 10, and we've agreed these are the 10. We're responsible for about 5 of them. AVAC is going to do the other 5. And so it's not quite 50-50. It's maybe 60-40, depends on what needs and the size of the communities. But the best part about that $100 million, it does not require a state match. I will say on a note that Lee Zeldin, when he's the administrator of EPA, came up last year and said that his goal was to have people wearing shirts. I love the EPA, and I would say I'm looking for my shirt because nobody else has given us $100 million. Mm-hmm. And we've Julie Kitka and I, we've gone, you know, we're asking, is there another $100 million available? Because we'd like to see this continue. Another note, and this is the USDA Rural Services grant, a high energy grant. This one's kind of, we qualified for a $2 million grant. And when I was in D.C. in December, we met with them. met with the assistant secretary, ran through our program, what we do. And so we had already successfully won the $2 million grant, and it wasn't too long before we came back going, we have discretionary funding of, say, $5 million more. Can you use it? The answer was yes. And so in February, I signed the grant. I signed a grant agreement for an additional $5 million for maintenance and improvements for ball fuel tanks in certain communities that are not getting complete replacements, but getting that. So what you will see in the capital or in the budget is a request for federal receipt authority to take this fund, these funds. But again, does not require any state match. So we continue to look for these opportunities.
So, Mr. Thayer, I have a question.
Yes, and I have an answer.
Well, maybe. You don't know what my question is. So right now, the Finance Committee is looking at deferred maintenance for schools. Four of those requests on that list are for bulk fuel restoration problems. Can't you guys do that?
Madam Chair, we don't have the funding for it. I'm saying these are designated projects that have been signed off by Denali Commission and that. But what I can tell you is there are, of those four communities, if we get another round of funding at $100 million, which we're trying for, the Committee of Napaskiak is number six on the list on the second round. The community of Marshall is number 14 on the list, and Hooper Bay is number 15 on the list. So if we were to get funding for those, they're pretty high on the list for the next round of funding. We don't have direct funds available. This year, I'll just say that this year, the capital budget does not include any money for powerhouses or bulk fuel. So the state is not investing into it, but we do have the $55 million from the feds that are investing. So if we were to get that additional funding, then these communities, the community of Gamble would actually be a number 111 on the list. And that's because we recently completed for the Native Village of Gamble repairs of done some early operation and maintenance for them. So yes, we could do it if we had funding, and mm-hmm. that's the ranking 6, 14, and 15 is what the ranking is. When we've talked to the EPA and they said, do you have a second round? These are the communities, and that's where they fall out on the ranking. So potentially.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Just in kind of in closing, I always like to bring up the Circuit Rider program. We do have these four gentlemen. They do travel all over Alaska, working on bulk fuel and powerhouses. And this is just a snapshot of these four gentlemen have close to 300 responses they've done. They've traveled to 50 different communities in the last year. You will also see we put numbers next to them, the number of times that they've dealt with the community. So we do have some that we would call frequent flyers as far as trouble for various reasons. We do training not only in the villages, but we also bring people from the villages to Seward, to AVTAC. One thing I will just raise as a concern is the longtime instructor for AVTAC, for powerhouses and bulk fuel is retiring, and they have not found a replacement. Mm-hmm. So that is a concern for us, is because we bring literally dozens of people from Alaska for training for a week or 2 weeks down there, and if we don't have that training, we're going to see that in the villages by not being able to maintain the equipment. So it's a concern for us. Last, and that is, as we have the federal funding awards and pending applications. This is all the federal awards we've received in the last few years. Where we say the largest match piece is the GRIP, and really we are down to $142 million. Everything else in the matches we already have matched for. But when you look at it completely, just in federal funding and the state match for these federal funds, is well over $700 million. In addition, Bradley is outside of that for $400 million. So we have an awful lot going on. We have two outstanding applications, one with federally congressional directed spending earmarks that we have made an application with Senator Murkowski on for a couple on Bradley in rural Alaska. And then there was also a Water Smart grant that we applied for Dixon Diversion that we have not heard back on. And with that, That's the team at AEA. Give or take a few.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Thank you.
All right.
Very
Thank
much.
You very much.
Especially for the prop that you brought. That is very cool and certainly gives
and
us.
I apologize. I didn't invite or did not introduce Tim Sandstrom. He's our chief operating officer. And due to the fact that I'm not supposed to carry anything over my right shoulder over 6 pounds,
yes,
as
yes.
you know, I had to bring, you know, so Tim accompanied me for other reasons in addition to carrying that.
Your Sherpa, yes.
My Sherpa.
Yes, very good. Well, thanks for doing that, Tim. Good. All right. So next up, we're going to hear an update on the Don Young Port of Alaska Modernization Program. And so I will invite forward Terry Umaton, Port Director, and Eric Adams, Port Manager.
Good, there we go. You just take the middle. You're going to run the program.
Welcome.
Through the chair. My name is Terry Umaton, Director of the Don Young Port of Alaska, newly appointed, 3 months in the role. And Eric, do you want to introduce yourself?
For the record, my name is Eric Adams. I'm with Jacobs Engineering. We're the program management consultant hired by the Port of Alaska to deliver the best in the Port of Alaska modernization program.
Very good. So as you trade off presenting, if you would just identify yourself each time for the secretary that's keeping the record.
Oh, great.
And the folks that are listening online.
Through the chair, I've just got a quick introduction, and then we'll turn it over to Eric for the presentation on the BESS and the PAMP update.
All right.
Madam Chair Giesel, members of the Senate Resources Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the state of Alaska's role in the Port of Alaska Modernization Program. The Don Young Port of Alaska is not simply a municipal asset. It is a statewide infrastructure, and the port handles the vast majority of the fuel, food, and consumer goods that move into South Central Alaska and continue on to communities across the state. Its reliability is directly tied to Alaska's economic stability, public safety, supply chain resilience, and emergency response capabilities. That is why the state of Alaska's investment in this program has been so important and continues to be important. The state has been a foundational funding partner in the Port of Alaska Modernization Program from the beginning. State contributions have supported the program from initial planning through major capital delivery, and they have helped move the program from concept to constructive to active use. State funding has already paid for real, tangible infrastructure. It supported the early planning and startup work that allowed the modernization effort to move forward and was instrumental in the delivery of the petroleum and cement terminal, which is one of the program's most significant completed milestones to date. That terminal is no longer just a future concept. It is infrastructure that has already strengthened the port's operational capabilities and helped advance long-term resiliency. In addition, state funding has supported the construction of the new port administration building and major stabilization work at the North Extension Stabilization Site. These are not isolated investments. They are connected components of a larger strategy to replace aging, vulnerable infrastructure and facilities that are safer, more reliable, and better suited to serve Alaska into the future. One of the most important points reflected in the program financing documents located on the port's website is that the state's role is both retrospective and prospective. In other words, state dollars have not only helped pay for work that is already complete or underway, but they are also essential to the next phase of the program. The next phase is the cargo terminal work, which we're starting in just a few weeks. Including Terminal 1, Terminal 2, and related supporting infrastructure, this is where the financing challenge becomes even more significant, and it's where continued state partnership remains critical. The planning documents show the state participation has served as a catalyst. It has helped close major funding gaps, supported matching requirements, and positioned the program to leverage federal funding. That is a very important point. State investment is not operating in isolation. It is helping to unlock and maximize other funding sources, including federal participation, in a way that reduces overall pressure on local funding mechanisms. From an executive perspective, that means the state's investment is doing more than paying for individual project elements. It is improving the overall financial structure of the modernization program. It is helping reduce the dependence on future local borrowing, helping to manage the burden that would otherwise fall on more heavily on tariff-supported revenues and local users, and allowing the program to advance in a more stable and strategic manner. The cash flow and plan of finance tell a clear and consistent story. The state of Alaska contributions have been essential to getting the port modernization effort to where it is today, and they remain essential to where it needs to go next. So the takeaway is straightforward. State of Alaska's investment in the Port of Alaska Modernization Program has already produced meaningful results in the form of completed and operational infrastructure. It has strengthened the port's ability to serve Alaska today, and at the same time, it remains a key part of the strategy for delivering the next generation of cargo infrastructure that Alaska will depend on tomorrow. In short, the state's support has been foundational, catalytic, and statewide in impact, and continued partnership will help secure that program remains not only a port project, but a durable investment in Alaska's long-term economic security and resilience. Thank you for letting me present today, and I'll turn it over to Eric for the PowerPoint presentation on the BEST program.
For the record, Eric Adams of Jacobs Engineering. I support the Port of Alaska as a program management consultant. So today we'll talk about the battery energy storage system. You hear me reference it as BEST to shorten it, so it's BEST Battery Energy Storage System. And I'm going to talk about the PAMP's project overview and how the BEST supports each one of those projects as we go forward in the PAMP. So what are we doing down there? We're modernizing the Port of Alaska's power system with the Battery Energy Storage System, BEST. Goals of the BEST project is a phased implementation pathway of independently beneficial electrical infrastructure upgrades to achieve the following goals. Improve the Port of Alaska power system resilience, maintain port operations and readiness during local and grid power outages. Reduce port-related energy costs by flattening power demand spikes, improving power quality, and reducing demand-related charges to providing economic value for port tenants, and modernizing the cargo and fuel handling operations. So there's two phases currently planned on the BEST. The first phase is underway right now. It's under contract. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We'll purchase and install a battery system for an electrical substation, supporting the new gantry cranes to be installed on the new Terminal 1. The new batteries will be used instead of a typical backup generator. And the electrical substation project is required to be operational prior to Terminal 1 completion. So the BEST is really a critical part of the overall power substation that we're building for Terminal 1 and to power the new three ship-to-shore cranes that are going to be placed on the dock. Batteries will perform better than a generator system. They will provide safer operation. They provide backup power sufficient to park the cranes during primary power loss. If you think about giant cranes, the big lifting organizations, you lift a container off the vessel, you move it over, putting on a truck chassis on the dock, and it drives off. If there's a power outage, primary loss during that time, those loads are lifted in the air, which is actually like a safety hazard. So we want to provide the battery energy storage system as a backup to make sure that they can safely lower those loads and place them on the dock or back on the vessel. If you think about all the ship workers down there, the truck drivers and the dock workers, it's just really make sure we can safe the cranes out if there's a primary power loss during operations. Create greater efficiency, capture regenerative power from the cranes. The older cranes that are on the dock right now do not allow that, but the new three to ship to shore cranes that one vendor is purchasing to put on the docks, when they become operational, you'll be able to put the regenerative power. That happens when the load is lowered by the crane down, produces power, and will feed back to the battery energy storage system. And overall, support smoother operations, support voltage stability during crane operations. As you turn all three of those cranes on, there's large spikes of power that come on, and this battery energy storage system will help smooth those out.
Mr. Adams, Senator Klayman had a question.
When we talk about batteries, is this what kind of batteries are we talking about? I assume it's much larger than goes in things like a electric car kind of thing.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Klayman. Actually, got a diagram down here to show you, but I think it's slide 8. We'll get to it. But the large, I don't have the exact dimensions. But overall, each battery system is capable of storing about 7,700 kilowatts of power. They're pretty large. They're much larger than a car one.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Klayman.
What kind of materials? I read recently that Google bought called an iron air battery for one of its power, one of its structures or one of its data banks. And what kind of storage is this that we're talking about buying?
through the chair, Senator Klayman. I can provide that information to you. I don't have it memorized off the top of my head, but the two mega packs that we're buying are coming from Tesla mega packs. I don't have the exact makeup of it. My engineers just approved it and passed that on, and they're on order, and I can supply that information if requested.
Thank you.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might have already partially answered this, but on a similar note, similar avenue, how does this BESS project compare to the Tesla BESS installed at the South Central Power Plant by Chugach? I think a number of us got a chance to tour that. Is this a similar sized facility?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, great question. I'm sorry, I'm not very familiar with that project. I know it was built, but I don't know the size of it. But I can tell you the first phase of the BESS down here at the port that's under contract is about 15,400 kilowatt hours total. And I'm not sure how big the other power plant, the project you were talking about.
Thank you. And those are also Tesla batteries. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, through the chair. So the size is pretty big, but how, while the port is in full operation, how long do you believe you'll be able to provide power with the battery?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, that's a great question. Phase one of the BESS program will only be able to allow to safe out the cranes that I talked about, so a very limited time. Phase one, but phase two will be a larger investment if we move forward with that. It's currently on a study, and I don't have those exact specifics, but once that study is done in a couple months, we'll be able to share that with you. But phase one is just to support the crane operations, the safe out of the cranes. So it's very limited in duration and time. It's about probably an hour of crane working opping time to safe the three cranes out, and that's about it.
And just follow-up, quick follow-up, Senator Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you. So do you have a journal of amount of the average outage that you have and how many you have a year? Is there anything like that that we could actually get a better understanding on the what you're going to provide yourselves with this battery product?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, yeah, we can provide that journal with you on the power outages for the port, for the cranes.
Very good. I don't see any other questions. I'll let you go on.
Thank you, through the chair. So as I mentioned, two phases of the BESS that we have here. The first one is just to save out. The second one is a future phases of the BESS that we're studying right now. That's to expand the BESS to supply power services to all of the Port of Alaska down there, all the new projects that I'm going to be talking about, to make sure that we can support that information and have that ongoing grid operations, as a senator asked. Allow for ongoing operations during grid outages, and we're starting an interconnect agreement with CEA, but enable grid services if CEA decides to use those larger battery systems. So this is a map kind of looking overall the general concept of BESS phase one and phase two. What you have here on the left side of the power slide here is what we're calling the phase one BESS. Those are the two Tesla mega packs that are on order right now that I was mentioning. And then the rest of the darkened area there is a substation. And then the light gray that's up against the Jaybird Bluff, the trees at the bottom of the slide, is what we're talking about, phase two. And that's currently under study to determine how big it is right now. Typically, we look at 12 additional Tesla mega packs, but we're going to refine that as the study advances and we move forward. And so this is kind of a key picture here. If you see the road right at the top of there, as I talk about the North Extension stabilization and how that supported the BESS substation going here to prevent erosion and sliding off into the sea.
Yes.
Through the chair, I think with Senator Rauscher.
If you would identify yourself for the record.
Sorry, Director of the Port of Alaska, Daniel, Port of Alaska, Terry Amatum. I think what this helps answer some of your question, the second phase will be able to create a microgrid for the port, and the longevity of that, the lifetime of that will be also with the lifetime of the port. We're looking to create this microgrid so that we don't just have the ability to safe out those cranes, we have the ability to actually operate through the microgrid with the BESS system so that the cranes don't actually have to stop work at all. They get to keep using the power that we've stored up in the BESS so they can operate in case there is an emergency or an issue with power.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. For the record, Eric Adams of Jacobs Engineering. To add on to what the director said, yes, these two batteries are just to safe out the cranes, very limited use right now. Okay, here's a quick snapshot timeline of the electrical substation BEST design build project. Contractors awarded in June of 2025. We start construction on that part of the program in 2026 with the final completion in August of 2028. That August of 2028 will be a key date that I'll mention coming up and how that supports the other projects that are ongoing. But this is key to make that date in August of 2028. So the forward momentum on the PAMP and how the BEST relates to all the future projects, going to quick give an overview of those, of the projects ongoing and how the BEST supports those. So these are the PAMP projects I'm sure most of you are familiar with. The purple are the completed ones. Over there on the right, we have the petroleum cement terminal that Terry was talking about earlier. We have a south floating dock. We have a new admin building. We have the north extension. And cargo terminal one is notice to proceed is scheduled to be issued on Monday, March 16th. And so get ready for a lot of noise this summer as we install a bunch of piling down at the Port of Alaska. And cargo terminal two, we are kicking off design this week on. So here's an overall snapshot of the program timeline. You can see on the left screen, the purple PCT is finished up. Cargo terminal one under contract. We're going to start construction this year. You can see the other cargo terminal two, petroleum terminal, demolished remaining cargo terminal, and the NES two. And the goal is to have the BEST, both phases of the BEST, if they move forward, completed at the end of cargo terminal two. So completed work to date that the BEST will benefit is you heard Terry talk about the petroleum cement terminal. This was completed in 22. It's the first of the four terminals to be replaced by the PAMP, located south of the existing terminals to allow continued operations without interruption, serves both petroleum and cement transfer operations. And why this is key is all the fueling down at the Port of Alaska, we have to maintain two fuel offloading points down there because of the tankers coming in, supporting Anchorage International Airport and our military, is all this fuel transfers through a valve yard that we call, and the future phase of the BEST will support keeping the power on at the valve yard if there's a major grid disruption. And so that way fuel can continue to flow to Anchorage International Airport and our military personnel if needed. Next project that was completed was in 2024. This is the admin building. It's key. This will be tied into the future phases of the BEST as well, the phase two that we're talking about, just to make sure that the port in can continue operations and support their vendors as they're offloading fuel and cargoes during a power outage. The North Extension stabilization, if you remember the road I mentioned on slide 8, which is kind of key, this was completed in 2025. This North Extension stabilization successfully stabilize the shoreline, widen the marine shipping lane, and increase the safe vessel docking at the cargo terminals. This is right in front of that road that I had back there on slide 8. What we did in 2023 is we picture a drill at your house. We basically drilled a 6-foot diameter hole, about 1,000 of them, and we filled them with cement. We brought them up anywhere from 60 to 100 feet deep, and that basically stabilized the embankment where the BEST is so it doesn't slide off into the water during an earthquake. We've used this tactic near the PCT and during the 2018 earthquake at Anchorage. It worked just as it's planned to, really stabilize the shoreline. You get no sloughing, and you protect the investment that you put in. 2024, we demolished the failed structure. You can see part of it on the left there. That's NES2. We stabilized that shoreline. And then 2025, we finished putting up the armor rock to prevent erosion going into the shipping lanes. In progress work, that's ongoing right now. Cargo terminals 1 and 2. Most people know the new terminals will replace the existing ones with seismically capable structures, built 140 feet seaward of the existing structure, to reduce sedimentation impact, improve berthing safety, and allow for continued port operations during construction. And this will tie in the terminal ones and two into the BEST here in a second. Both cargo terminals will support general cargo handling and operations and mooring for military and cruise ships. The new terminal one is being constructed further south of the existing terminals. We're limited with land there on both sides of it, and the key is to keep the port operational as we go forward.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said these are more seismically capable. Can you give me kind of a rough estimate of what that means? You know, the 18 quake was, what was it? It was a 6 point something. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. Oh, 7.0? My apologies. I'm big. Large, yes. So how much more capable is these compared to the previous structure, compared to the earthquake you went through?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. We did a site-specific seismic study on this for each of the projects. And to give you an indication is I'm going to use a PCT, for example, that project that was the shoreline stabilization was done. You could see during that earthquake as it went across, it basically split the ground up to where we did the deep soil mixing, and then it was solid, and then it took off on the other side of that. Hmm. And so it's really making, be able to protect the pipes and the access to that. I can't, I'm not a seismic engineer, so I'm not going to be able to answer the exact difference, but this is rated to be withstand higher than that earthquake.
Hmm. Okay.
These are. And I can get the exact information, but it's really robust in seismic.
Okay. And then just.
Yes, follow up, Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you. The other piece you mentioned is reduce sedimentation impact. So does this mean you're going to have to dredge less often?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. As you know, the Army Corps of Engineers right now has a contract out there to dredge at Anchorage Harbor. Maybe you're not aware of it. Throughout the years, they're maintained to dredge that face there, and the goal is moving this 140 feet out is to prevent additional sedimentation buildup. All the models have proven that it will reduce it, but we can't control how the weather changes and those items, right? And so we believe there will be less sedimentation building up there that the Army Corps of Engineers will have to dredge.
Okay.
We will wait and see.
Okay. Thank you.
We believe.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm saying this is giving me flashbacks to the Anchorage Assembly.
Yes.
Many, many long assembly meetings talking about the port. So I looked up, it was 7.1 followed by a 5.7 6 minutes later. My question is, and I know you've answered this before, but just to refresh my memory, there was a controversy between Mattson and Tote about a cost causer, cost payer model versus a blended tariff for the sort of roll on, roll off, lift on, lift off. Can you remind me which of those won out? What is the funding mechanism that the tariff is going to?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it is a tariff per ton, and it is equitable across all users on the port.
So Mattson.
Mattson Tote tariff per ton.
Yeah, okay.
Across the board. And that's the same for the users on the cement and petroleum side, too. There's some percentages over there, but for the most part, it is parity across the board per ton.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
$8.50 per ton right now.
Thank you, Mr. Amon.
Amatom.
Thank you. All right. Senator Kawasaki had a question also.
Yeah, just briefly. I thought George might ask, but the question about this port versus the port that is at Mackenzie, and it sounds like you're building out a lot so that you could get further out into the channel to avoid that. But one of the benefits I've heard for the other port as an alternate is that it is it's in the swift water now already. Can you make any comment to that?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, and motorcycle. Thank you, sir. I'm not really familiar with the Port of Mackenzie. I do know that it is in the Swift area. They probably, I'm not sure if the ship pilots have challenge parking there or not. Because of Swifter, I can't really speak to the Port Mackenzie facility.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Further questions, Senator Kawasaki?
No, thanks.
All right, Senator Rauscher.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The point he's making is Point Mackenzie is a deep water port, and it wouldn't need to be dredged. And he was just wondering, where are you with yours, and what's the cost on all that?
Oh.
Mr. Ramatan?
I'm going to defer,
actually. All right, Mr. Adams.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, what is the cost of the dredging?
Of dredging each year, yeah.
That is a great question, but that is a federal project that I do not keep close tabs on how much the federal pays to dredge that Anchorage Harbor. It changes each year, but we can get that information and respond.
And then I
threw the chair to Senator Rauscher just to follow
up.
We don't see that bill either. That's why I was deferring to Jacobs if maybe they knew something more about that, but the port does not see that bill.
That's fine.
We do have smaller, lower costs when it comes to private companies that we have do dredging, but it's nowhere near what the Corps would be.
And then
follow-ups and interruptions.
I had a quick follow-up, and I hate to go back, but I'm going to go back for a minute because I'm kind of hung up on batteries for some reason. So I just want to know, do you have a charging time for 14 banks of batteries, and what charges 14 banks of batteries back to a full charge is just an interest of mine, trying to figure out what's going to the future holds for operating such a battery pack.
For the record, this is Eric Adams, Jacobs Engineering. Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, great question. If you remember, we can provide that information to you coming up. We're currently studying that right now, which is the phase two part of the BESS, all those other additional battery energy storage systems that are shown on slide 8. That's just a preliminary site concept, and we're currently studying that right now. But when that's completed, we can provide that information to you.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. I think you can go on to slide 19.
Thank you. Status cargo terminals 1 and 2. Terminal 1 is being constructed first to allow port operations to continue. The construction contract was awarded last year to allow adequate time for material procurement and work plan coordination. As I mentioned before, construction kicks off next week, Monday, March 16th. Terminal 2 design was recently awarded with a contract kickoff meeting this week will be occurring. So here's a quick snapshot of the cargo Terminal 1 timeline. Contract was awarded last April. Material procurement has been ongoing since May. Owner's permits received from the federal government and everything else in December, and we start next week. I go back to key, this partial dock complete and crane delivery August. That ties in the battery energy storage system, the port substation, as I was talking about. This has to be the BESS, and the substation has to be online before the cranes arrive in August. Then the vendor, Matson, switches over to the partial dock use in March of 2029 and finish up Terminal 1 at the end of December in 2029. So next slide is just kind of a little graphic showing cranes arrive in August 2028. Basically, two-thirds of the dock will be built. Cranes will be unloaded and construction completed in fourth quarter of 2029. Cargo Terminal 2 timeline, as I mentioned, we're kicking off design this week. In 2029, construction will begin, and end of 2032-33, construction complete. So planning for future projects and how that ties into the BESS. Petroleum terminals, as I mentioned, at Port of Alaska, we need 2 unloading fuel terminals. We're going to replace the existing Pre-Oil 2, which is in bad shape, with a new petroleum terminal. This modernized PT will accommodate a larger, more modern petroleum shipping vessels year-round. As I mentioned, all the fuel goes to the valve yard that supplies Anchorage International Airport and our military, and we look to tying in the future phase two of the BESS to support the power needs of that valve yard as we bring the petroleum terminal online. Why the North Extension Stabilization 2, similar to NES-1, is important is to continue to stabilize that shoreline, and we can expand the BESS out even farther if needed, multiple phases down the road if somebody makes that decision to go that way. And then demolishing the remaining cargo terminal 3 is pretty straightforward, just so it doesn't fall in the water and impair shipping lanes. And here's a quick photo of PAMP at completion. From the other end, you can see the tote vessel there, and then the cranes will be the Matson vessels. And the bottom left is the NES-1 and NES-2. So with that, thank you for giving us time to testify today.
Well, thank you. That was very interesting. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, would you be able to update us a little bit on the MARAD lawsuit?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, Terry Amatum, Port Director. I met with the administrator of MARAD last week in D.C. We had a constructive conversation. It's in the appellate district right now for the lawsuit. I believe the mayor's office, along with some of the legal team, are actually meeting with the Department of Justice in about a week because that's where it's going to ultimately land. It will go from MARAD giving either a blessing or a denial, and then it will go to the Department of Justice to make an ultimate decision on whether or not they want to settle this lawsuit with the municipality of Anchorage. If not, we'll continue down the appellate process.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I remember the initial award was it $300 million?
$361 million, I believe.
$361 million. can you disclose anything about what number we are looking to settle on? Or
we have asked for more than that because we had decommission costs. The municipality had decommission costs. We had to go in and actually remove the sheet pile. Mm-hmm. So there's another 100 million or so on there. So it's a much higher number than the 361.
And follow up, Madam Chair, have our lawyers, or are you able to tell us sort of the probable outcome as a dollar figure?
I'm not.
Okay.
I well, know what I know what I've asked for.
Well, I think we're all hopeful it will be in the several hundred million dollar range, and that would go a long way to helping build this project.
No question. No question. Thanks for the question. That was great.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with all this modernization, is there a capacity upgrade that comes with it?
For the record, Eric Adams, Jacob Engineering Group, the program management firm hired to support the Port of Alaska. Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. I guess I want to clarify one question back to you, if you don't mind. When you say capacity upgrades, meaning the containers or the fueling or –
I suppose a little bit of everything, just you know, either how quickly you can get something unloaded or able to unload more in a, you know, say a week period of time. You know, I think most all the port operations seem to go on a weekly schedule.
Yes, thank you for following up on that. Through the chair, Senator Myers, great question. The new ship-to-shore cranes are larger, can be able to lift heavier loads. Right now, the vendors sometimes have to load the vessel one way to make sure they can offload everything. These ship-to-shore cranes that they are procuring now will be able to reach clear across the vessel, in theory, unloading a little bit faster. But I can't speak to the exact time on how fast they will be able to unload. But in theory, they should be unloading faster.
Through the chair, through the chair, Giesel, Senator Myers, just a quick follow-up on that. There's a couple of items to note in this. These larger cranes, when we increase the capacity for these larger cranes to come into the Port of Alaska, they are much more efficient. They are much, much larger, and it will allow Matson or any other ship that uses low-low equipment to bring larger ships in, which would create efficiency in and of itself. Just more containers would be allowed to come into the market on a weekly basis. So just that is an efficiency. The best project, when we create this microgrid and we have everything functioning, I wish you could go back a slide or two and show the end of the port as we're going to see it or hoping to see it. We have one of the most unique services in the world coming to the Don Young Port of Alaska, and that is TOTE, a ro-ro ship where they roll on, roll off. We don't know in the future if that one unique service is going to continue with that company. So the BESS will actually allow us to power more cranes if we need them. So that in and of itself, again, is a huge factor for being able to accommodate bigger ships, more ships, and maybe even different diversified vessels coming into the Port of Alaska. So that BESS is really going to strengthen us in that regard down the road too. And we've told that to TOTE, our customer, our user group, like, we're prepared to help you if you ever make a change in your business model. We will be prepared for that. That's one of the contingencies here with having the BESS, is being able to help them out if they have to make a change for whatever reason.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Dunbar.
Just a very small question, Madam Chair. I think a number of us had a chance to go to take the ships and go and see the pilings go down at the water level. And, and you know, it's really pretty impressive. A lot of them are corroded to the point where you can almost stick your thumb through. And so they have to be completely removed. What happens to all that metal? I mean, it's really a tremendous amount of metal you're going to be pulling out of there. Is that going to be recycled in any way? Is it going to be disposed of here? Is it going to be shipped back to the Lower 48? What happens to the metal and the pilings we're going to remove?
For the record, Eric Adams, Jacobs Engineering. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, great question. The Terminal 1 contractor gets the metal, and they can dispose of it as they see fit. I believe most of it is going to be taken back to Seattle and sent through the recycle yards at some point, but it's part of the contract. They get any of the demolished removals that they need to do. So I don't have the exact number of piling that will be removed underneath the old dock, but it's quite a few, but much smaller, the 12-inch piling instead of 6-foot that we're putting in now.
Thank you.
Through the chair, to Senator Dunbar, director of the Port of Alaska Terry Omatum. I've got some photos here of the current existing state of the pilings and then of the new ones that are down in the Port of Anacortes that I'll leave with you also, so you can kind of take a look at where we're at with these guys literally chainsawing ice off the off the front-facing pilings and the new ones that are in Port of Anacortes that are coming up that we're going to drive this summer. So I'll leave these with you, too, so you can take a look at it.
Thank you. Senator Clayman.
Just a question. It's a little bit earlier modernization for there's a cement storage facility that was completed, I went around 2012, 2014. How is that doing, and is it working as planned?
The cement storage facility on the port?
Yes.
Yeah, as far as I know with AGI, they're thrilled with it. Okay. I've only had one conversation when I first started a few months back about that, but there was no issues that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I see no further questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Omatum, Mr. Adams. That was a great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
I also want to thank Representative Donna Mears, who has joined us and been sitting in for about half the meeting. This concludes our meeting today. Our next meeting will be on Friday, March 13th. At that time, we will be addressing HGR 29, ban on Russian seafood, and a first hearing on Senate Bill 275, natural gas projects, income tax surcharge. We've invited Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and AGDC to join us. So at this time, we will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:40 p.m.